This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm joined by John Sonmez, life coach for software developers, author of Soft Skills, the Software Developer's Life Manual, and a Pluralsight author. Thanks for joining me, John.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
So sure, yeah. So I am a software developer turned life coach for software developers. I've been developing software for about 15 years, and then I found that sort of my better calling in life was to actually help software developers, in all areas of their life. So I run a website, a pretty large blog called simpleprogrammer.com. And I basically do a lot of different things around helping software developers from within technical training to career development to all kinds of things, including like fitness and health and even finance. And I do that through, different mediums, through my blog, of course, through YouTube videos, through podcasts and books and other, whatever content I produce. So
a lot of developers kind of think that knowing the programming languages and knowing the technologies are the main things, but you have a very different approach. It's all about soft skill, or not all, but a lot of it is about soft skills.
Yeah, I think there's a certain level that your skill takes you to, right? And it's important to have a decent level of skill. But I find that, and I found in my career that there's sort of a diminishing returns on increasing your skills. I mean, you always want to be increasing your skills, but there's other areas of your life that when lacking can hurt you more, hold you back more is really the thing that I discovered. And so, I tend to focus, I tend to say that I view a software developer from a holistic approach. Like I take a holistic approach, basically meaning that, if you have good technical skills, if you're good at some programming language, you're good at creating algorithms or solving problems, that's going to take you so far in life and in your career, but it's not going to take you as far as you can go. In order to really, really excel, in order to really, really, not just be successful, but be happy, you can't ignore these other things. You can't ignore your health, for example. You can't ignore your finances. You can make a whole lot of money, and then if you don't know what to do with it, you can end up broke, right? And you could be miserable because you have the wrong mindset. You don't understand, how to appreciate things and how to have a positive attitude. And so there's a lot of other things that I think makes a software developer successful and content in their career than just having those technical skills.
But a lot of people come out of college, maybe go into a startup, or even not out of college, go into a startup, and it does become very much about the skills, the newest thing. Like I've been doing programming for 15, 16 years professionally, and I haven't done much Angular. So for the likes of me, I've kind of come to the realization that if I was to start doing Angular on a day-to-day basis, it would probably be a step back in my career. But a lot of people don't seem to realize that and continue progressing, let's say, with the very technical skills and ignoring the more managerial skills or the ability to interact, to deal with the politics of a company.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I think that's very true, right? So, I mean, you could be the best Angular developer that there is right now, and that could be the hottest technology, right? And if no one knows who you are and knows what your skills are, it doesn't matter. And second of all, even if someone did know, right, the kind of people that can judge, between the 95 percentile Angular developer and the 99 percentile, it's a very, very small, right? It's really only the 99 percentile people that can make that judgment anyway. So if you get to a certain point in your skill level, right, then it's much more important. For example, one of the first things that I teach developers, especially starting out developers, is how to market themselves, how to build a personal brand, how to build sort of a reputation. Because if people know who you are, that's a lot more valuable than having an extreme level of skill. And no one, you could be coding in your basement by yourself. And if no one knows that you're the most wonderful developer in the world, it doesn't matter. It's not going to get you, it's not going to translate into higher pay. It's not going to translate into better jobs. You're just going to be kind of grumpy and angry at the world because they don't appreciate your talent. So I think there's definitely some truth to that.
So then how does a developer build a brand to become known and become recognized?
So, I kind of reverse engineered this when I set out, I was a developer for about 15 years and I had pretty good success in my career. Right. And I did okay. And I was usually like a senior developer, a mentor in a lot of places, and I made a good salary, but I didn't really start to really like what I'd say really make it until I sort of stumbled upon this, right? So, so what I did was I started off by creating a blog, and the idea behind the blog was just to get, just to like communicate to my coworkers and to my boss, and just to get my ideas on paper, so to speak, and organize my thoughts. And as that blog started to get popular, all these opportunities started coming to me, and then I started doing other things. So I sort of kind of figured out how to market myself by accidentally doing it, right? So, and this took a process of maybe, I guess it's been like 4 or 5 years in order to sort of build up a reputation. But now I kind of reverse engineer that. And so now I could kind of dissect that. And so if I were to say, okay, you know, what did I do? And then I've talked to a lot of successful software developers too that have built up brands and reputations. I said, okay, what can I do? You know, how could I accelerate this process? And so what I would really do, you know, for someone starting out is I would start off by doing the simplest, you know, thing that you could do for a developer typically is to create a blog, right? Put your writing out there, you know, and often I'll go and I'll speak at a conference and I'll talk to developers about marketing themselves specifically. And I'll ask everyone to raise their hand if they have a blog, right? And about, you know, out of a room of maybe like 100, 200 developers, like half the room will raise their hand. Okay. Yeah. I've got a blog.
That's pretty big. I thought it would be less.
Yeah, yeah. So that's – well, this is at a developer conference, right? So
okay, so you're already got the people that are more interested. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'll say, okay, hold your hand up. Keep your hand up if you've updated your blog in the last month. Okay, so, you know, most of the hands will drop at this point, right? Then maybe there's 10%, maybe like 10 or 20 developers depending on the size of the room. I'll say, okay, keep your hand up if you've blogged in the last week. Usually there's only going to be like 2 or 3 hands up. And then I say, keep your hands up if you blogged every week for the last year. And sometimes there's one hand up, but mostly there's zero. So then right there, you know, as far as marketing yourself, I say, if you have your hand up, or if you're willing to commit to blogging once a week for 52 weeks, you will be in the top less than 1 percentile. Of developers as far as marketing themselves using a blog. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, it's all saturated. There's too much competition. No. If you could blog just consistently once a week, you're going to be in the top probably 0.01% of all developers just by doing that one thing. So that's why I start there. As I say, okay, the first thing that you need to do is create a blog and, you know, and update that weekly. And that's sort of your launching point. And, you know, there's more to it, right? It's not just like create a blog and write anything. You know, you want to build a sort of a brand around this. And what I usually recommend is for a developer to specialize. So pick some kind of thing. You want to be this big fish in this small pond to start out, at least. You know, not everyone can be Uncle Bob Martin, right? Not everyone can be a Scott Hanselman on the Microsoft side, right? You know, you think of these kind of famous developers, and they're generalists. But if you start out as a specialist, then you could be, you know, the person who knows more about iOS buttons than anyone else in the world, and you're that expert in that. And anytime someone thinks about iOS buttons, they think about you. You could be that person, and that wouldn't be very hard for you to do. So that's really the start. That's the beginning advice I'd give anyone to learning how to market themselves. And you know, for a developer, the lowest barrier of entry is right there.
Have you had anyone come back to you saying they'd followed your suggestions and it made a significant difference for them?
Yeah. So I've had a bunch of people, right? Cause I do a course on how to market yourself as a software developer. And that's where I first started giving out this advice. And so I got some feedback from that. And then I've given some talks on this, but then I created a free, like 3-week course over email called How to Create a Blog That Boosts Your Career. And it's just a free course that someone can sign up for. And over 3 weeks, it sends you like 2 lessons a week. And I was surprised how well that did. Like I get about 50 developers that sign up per day to that course.
Nice.
And I've got actually a list of graduates. When someone graduates from it, I give them the opportunity to join my list if they do the homework assignments. And that list is growing and growing. Every day I get back emails from developers. I usually get about, I'd say somewhere between 5 to 10 emails a day of developers that have created brand new blogs. So now that doesn't mean that they're going to execute and follow through and, you know, but a lot of them have. A lot of them have started this blogging course and I think it's been live for about 3 months now. And there are some developers that have gone and blogged every single week for 3 months. So I'm starting to see a lot of success coming from this now. And I've gotten some stories back now from developers that said, I got a new job. I was able to get a raise. You know, I was able to raise my contracting rates. So it really does work.
In your book, I've read a good portion of it. You talk about how developers often don't identify career goals, and that can be a very limiting thing for them.
Yeah. I think that's very true, right? I think, and I group myself into this early in my career. I knew that I wanted to get a better job and make more money. that was my kind of career goal.
I'm on the list. And,
but that's not really a good enough goal, right? It's not a specific goal. You know, I learned kind of from the fitness industry, from doing bodybuilding, and from finance too, from doing trading and real estate investment. You have to have very finite goals if you want to achieve those goals. And so in our careers, we typically don't do this, right? We typically just we don't have an idea of what we want to do. So I think it's really important to have goals. You know, even if these goals, you know, generally put you in the direction you want to go, they don't have to be so specific as to like where I'm going to be in 5 years, right? But you know, goals around like I want to read. Let's say that I had a goal of I want to read one technical book every month, right? That's a pretty good goal, and that's gonna move me in the direction that I want to go to advance my career. Or maybe it's, you know, I want to become an expert in this particular area. So having some kind of goal, something that you're aiming for is really important. Otherwise, you're kind of just drifting. Like, you don't know what to aim for and what you're supposed to do in order to get there. So, I mean, it really depends on what your passions are, or what your motivation is in your career. But having, you know, at least sitting down and thinking about it and saying, okay, what would my goal be for this year? Like, what, by the end of this year, what do I want to accomplish? You know, and if you're in a corporate environment, maybe it's you want to get to that next, grade level of pay level or whatever, the, you know, climb up the ladder. If you're a freelancer, maybe it's you want to increase your hourly rate or increase your clients so that you have a higher bill rate. If you're just in a smaller company, maybe it's you want to move up, or you want to spearhead a new project or learn a new technology. You know, whatever it is, you got to figure out what that is so that you can start making steps towards that goal. Because, you know, once you figure out a goal, then what you do if you want to reach that goal is you break it down and you work backwards from it. You say, okay, if I want to achieve this goal, you know, what steps does it take? Like, what does it look like in reverse? If I already achieved the goal and I rolled the tape backwards, what would I have seen, the steps that got me there? And those are the milestones that you use. Now play it forward and have it happen.
Yeah, I think your idea of having small but very definable goals is really important, because I meet people who are, you know, just at meetups or just starting their careers, and they have, you know, they'd say to me, oh, did you plan to be where you are now? And I'm going, no, because, well, you know, I took a job and my background is really telecommunications. But then I moved to Budapest, and there aren't that many telecommunications research jobs in Budapest. So right. I ended up doing .NET, and then from there I stayed with .NET. But I transitioned from one industry to another industry, typically punctuated by layoffs due to downturns in the economy or company mess-ups. It's impossible to plan something like, a 5-year goal. But the idea of saying, I want to get to that management position, or I want to get to being the architect in something, and then you pick your little steps, is much more attainable.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's amazing some of the things, you know, outside. A lot of my influence comes outside of the world of software development, right? To a lot of kind of marketers in general, and, you know, kind of these kind of motivational speakers and type of, you know, who I really identify with. And these guys have some audacious goals, right? I mean, it's like, you know, I listen to some of these tapes and some seminars, and it's like, okay, my goal is to make $100,000 a month. Like, that's, and it's like for some,
legally,
you know,
legally or otherwise,
legally, right? Okay. This, you know, to go from 10,000 a month to 100,000, and it's amazing. Like, you know, as a software developer, maybe, you know, obviously if you're working as an employee, you're probably not going to be able to do that legally. But if you think outside the box, if you think entrepreneurially, if you think about other things, you could be. It's a possible goal. It's a definitely achievable things, but, you know, I just use that as an example to show how much we limit our goals. Like, you know, do you think you could become the director of software development at your company? Yes, you can. Why couldn't you? Right. You know, it's like, you know, people don't even think about these things. So, you know, it's definitely a lot of things that we might not think are achievable. Sometimes we tend to set goals that are way too small. You know, we don't think big enough. You know, it's better to just to try to think as big as possible is what I found. Because, you know, a lot of the goals that I had set for myself that seemed so out of reach, I mean, ridiculously out of reach, I blew past. So, I mean, and that just shocks me now when I think about some of these goals that I set, and I'm like, wow, you know, 5 years ago, I had dreamed of achieving X, and now I've achieved X times 10. How is that even possible? But, you know, it starts with thinking big and having a big goal, and, you know, and really, really trying to aim for that rather than just drifting and letting life happen to you.
I think I came across a quote, I think it was by Richard Branson, and he was saying, just say you can do it and then figure out how to do it later. So same idea, you know, say you can take on that big task, you can take that responsibility, even if you don't know how to, because that's how you progress.
Yeah, I love that. I love that idea. I call it, you know, fake it until you make it.
Yes, that's one of the chapters in your book. Actually, yeah. So and I'm going to move on slightly. Another one, this talk is primarily following a lot of the chapters in your book. One of the things that you talk about are the soft skills that developers need. What soft skills would you say are most important for a developer?
So I think definitely, I mean, not at the top of the list, right? So I guess it's good to step back a little bit and define soft skills, right? So the way I'm defining them, at least. So to me, soft skills is any skill that's not a hard skill. How's that for definition?
Fair enough.
Right?
So what's a hard skill?
So a hard skill is a technical skill. So anything that's not a technical skill. So this would include what typically people call soft skills, which is people skills. That's included in there. But there's also, you know, financial acumen, you know, health and fitness, mind, you know, anything that's not technically a technical skill. So so as far as, you know, looking at that broad picture, I would still probably rank as number one people skills. The soft skill, right? Being able to interact with people. You know, the example I always use is I say, okay, when you go into work, what's the first thing that you do? I'll quiz you here.
Well, I say hello to my colleagues. And actually, I say hello to the gentleman at reception and ask him how his day is.
And then you sit down at your desk, and what's the first thing you do?
I probably check the email.
Exactly. And who sends you email? Does computers send you email, or do people send you email?
I'm hoping no one, in all honesty, because if no one is sending me an email, things are going okay.
But unless it's a build break message, right, that's automated, typically people send us email, right? And it's like you go through your day, and, you know, I challenge software developers, and I say your job is not to write code. It's actually to interact with people. And you know, if you go through your day and you look at all the different things that you do throughout the day, every time it leads back to people, right? You talk with the coworkers, you answer email, you have meetings. It's all people, right? Face-to-face people, some of these things, most of the things that you're doing. And then, in fact, when you go to write the code, it's like we don't write zeros and ones or assembly language. We write – the way that we write code is so that people can read it, right? We're you know, we consider someone to be a good coder, not necessarily if they can program the most amazing algorithm, but if their code is readable. That's usually the number one thing that we check when we say, oh, this guy's good or not, right? And so my whole point is that it all comes back to people, right? It all comes back to dealing with people. And when you look at careers and what's going to help you the most in your career, it's not going to be the best coder in the planet. It's going to be, can you interact with people? Can you, in fact, you know, a most valuable person to have on your team is not the most technically skilled person. It's the person who makes everyone else better. You know, if you can be that person, that's a multiplier. That's a force multiplier for the entire team. So developing the people skills to be able to interact well with others, to be able to communicate your ideas effectively, right? Because even if you have great ideas, but you can't communicate those ideas, it does no good. And to be able to, you know, to get the team to work together, to be able to resolve conflicts, you know, to be able to move forward and progress, and to get people to want to follow your ideas and follow your leadership, those are really valuable skills that I think that are probably the most important to not just to software developers, to anyone, really.
I think in my very first job, I was a desktop support. So I was forced to go around to people and help them out with their computers. But from then on, I always, rather than sending an email, I would go a couple of stories down over to the next building to talk to a person, simply because you have that interaction and you have a better understanding. And it's not just sort of anonymous John Doe over in the other building. Oh, it's the guy we go for coffee. And those skills, again, are something that a lot of developers don't necessarily have. So how would you say they should develop them if they don't have them, if they're the more introverted type?
Okay. So the first thing that I would recommend is to go and get this book, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. This is like just a must-read book. I read this book once a year, sometimes twice a year, just because I need to remember the things that are in this book. And this is, I mean, this is a book that literally changed my life. I used to be a very big person who believed in negative reinforcement as opposed to positive. Like, why should you reward someone for doing wrong? You should give them punishment so that they learn from their, you know, learn to do the right thing. And after I read this book, it totally flipped my viewpoint. I said, never, ever give negative reinforcement, only positive, because that will not work. So it just goes to show you how little I knew about interacting with people. And I think most people could really benefit from this book. There's so many good, it's based on principles, you know, principles that don't change. And so that's really the first thing I would say is, like, read that book a couple of times, start practicing that, and that's a really good starting place. There are specific problems that you could address. One common one, I think, is that I, when I coach developers, is that they're shy.
Very common.
Yeah, and that stops you from doing a lot of things. So I've got a real good cure for being shy. It's simply this: this is my assignment to you. If you're shy, if you're serious about wanting to overcome your shyness, is you just have to do this one task and just say that John made you do it. You just go to the mall, you know, and your job for the day is to say hi to 50 random people. You're just going to make a check. You're just going to check it off when you say hi. That's it. And if you can accomplish that, you're gonna overcome. I'm not gonna say you're gonna be totally cured from your shyness, but in many cases, that's all it takes. That's all it took for me. I assigned myself that task when I was having problems with being shy, and that cured it for me. But it's gonna take you a long stride in the direction of overcoming that. If you can just, you know, it takes some guts to do this, but if you believe that this will help you, then you're much more likely to do this thing.
I'm getting the impression as well, a lot of companies, on a slightly different bent, are going after the no asshole rule.
Yeah.
During an interview process, if a person is competent and capable, but outgoing and friendly and will be a good fit, they're probably going to get hired, as opposed to necessarily a superstar coder who looks at the table and and won't talk.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly true. In fact, you know, from being on both ends of the interview process and coaching companies on the interview process, I can tell you that, you know, it's not 100% true, right? If someone has no skill at all, then we're not going to hire them. But most of us hire people we like. That's the biggest piece of interview advice that I give people. In fact, I give it in my book, is that you're really, the best thing you can do is to make the interviewer like you. And you can do that before the interview, right? You can start doing those things before. That's the real hack to get around the interview process and to really, but if you like someone, you're much more likely to, what happens is your mind starts coming up with reasons why they're good. You take their weaknesses and you compensate for them. You make excuses for them, right? And if you dislike someone, your mind does the opposite. You say, well, that person might know C sharp, but you know, whatever, doesn't know it this well or doesn't understand this particular thing. So, you know, you really want to make sure that you're liked, because that's what, you know, the reality of the world is, like, maybe we would like to live in this world where we just evaluate people purely on their skills and we don't use superficial judgments, but that's not true. What really happens in real life is that we use stereotypes, we use superficial judgments, and we hire people we like. So,
and we come to decisions quite quickly as well. I've noticed when I've interviewed a person, typically in the first couple of minutes, I have a very good feeling that, yes, I liked them and I'll continue for the rest of the half hour, or, yeah, no, not a hope. But then when I'm on the other side of it, I've read a few books on body language, and so I'll attempt to exploit that. You know, I don't sit directly across the table from an interviewer. I sit around the corner from an interviewer because it encourages a more collaborative environment.
Right.
You know, a few little things like that become quite important. You know, noticing a person's dress, complimenting on a, more so to female interviewers, you know, a nice brooch, something of that nature. All those little things can make a significant difference, and yet people don't do it. And when you come along and you're that one person who noticed, you're a hero suddenly.
Exactly. Yeah. If you want to get a good, you know, a good exercise too, is just to get, like, just get a job as a sales job, like a door-to-door or any kind of, you know, or doing phone cold call. Like, you'll get some good skills that will just help you to just, you know, get along with people and to make good first impressions, because you have to, you know, you'll learn them. So
So I'll move on a little bit. So in another one of your chapters discusses finding the right company. What's your advice for that?
So that's sort of a tough one, right? I think when you're first starting out, you don't really know, right? So I try to give kind of some ideas of the different kinds of companies in my book. But, you know, you've got small companies which have a certain feel to them, right? A small company, you have a lot of autonomy usually, but a lot of responsibility, right? So you might be wearing multiple hats. You might be doing a lot more work. You're not going to be sitting at your desk, you know, sleeping. You're going to get noticed, right? So for some people, that's a good thing. If that's what they want, you know, they want that visibility. But it's also probably kind of a risky, right? Small companies go under. You've got kind of the medium companies where you might have a little bit more protocol in place. You're not going to be able to fly under the radar either. But it's going to be a little bit perhaps more stable, and you still will have some kind of visibility. And then you've got kind of large companies, you know, and I've worked for all three. For example, I worked at HP, which is a large company, and in that company, you know, I still had autonomy, but I had no visibility. Like my day-to-day impact had nothing to do with HP. They didn't care. It didn't matter, right? You know, you can kind of get lost there. But I got to work on some pretty cool projects that I wouldn't be able to work on in small and medium companies. So, you know, huge multi-million-dollar projects. And that's, you know, for example, if you work at Google or Amazon or Apple or something like that, you might work on something really, really cool. Now, your impact is probably going to be really, really small into that. You got to kind of weigh it along the scales. And then the other major division with companies that I found is if the company's primary product is software or something else. And that's a really important thing to think about when you're interviewing at companies, because if the company's primary product is software, then typically the company understands software development and software developers get treated a little better, right? But if the company's primary product that they're selling is not software, and software developers are kind of just the support of the thing, it's a whole different dynamic. It might be one that you don't like. You know, you're not going to be
respect, a very different level of understanding for what you do and your value that you contribute.
Exactly. Yeah. So
I've had a couple of discussions with a few other blog authors on this kind of thing, and there's a general perception that if you're outside the software industry, you're just viewed as support staff. And there isn't an understanding that you're actually a key contributor to something.
Exactly. Yeah, that's often the case.
From, if let's say a prospective employee, let's say you're looking at a company, do you have any advice or suggestions on how you can get a better idea of what a company is like, but looking at it from the outside?
You know, the best thing to do, really, and this is going to be good anyway, right, is to talk to people who are working at that company, right? And this is going to be good for two reasons anyway, because you really don't want to get, I mean, you don't want to cold, you know, like if to use a sales analogy, cold call a company with your resume, right? You always want to get into a company through a referral.
Yeah.
So that means that you need to meet someone who works at that company. So that's going to serve two purposes for you. One, it's going to get, if you do want to apply for that company, it's going to get you a warm referral into the company, which is going to make it much more likely that you're going to get the job. But it's also going to give you an opportunity to pre-screen that company. Because if you're talking to, especially if you are able to talk to multiple people who work at that company, then you're going to have the true idea. Because a lot of, you know, I always get questions. In fact, I've done a couple of YouTube videos on my channel on this question of or statement, almost like a shoulder shrug of how did this happen? This company said we're going to work on ASP.NET MVC, and really they have this VB6 application that I have to develop.
Dear.
And like, how did this happen? This is what their job requirements say. And my answer is, well, did you check them out thoroughly? And did you talk to someone at that company? Do you know? You know, the truth is, a lot of times companies put on their job requirements what they wish that they, you know, could offer, where they want to be, where they anticipate they'll be, and that might not really reflect what the company culture is, what the technology is, what any of these things are. So you've got to kind of check it. You don't want to show up the first day and then realize that you're going to be working on a legacy VB6 app when you thought you're going to work on the new hot Angular, you know, thing. So you want to talk to people in the company, and they're gonna tell you the truth. You're gonna get a better idea.
Yeah, I agree. I'll add a couple of things to that as well. So I have known people in companies, and I needed some advice on a particular, I think, big data issue. So the person I knew put me in touch with another person in a company whom I met for coffee. Now we meet for lunch, and now I have a very good perspective on what's going on inside that particular company. Meetups are another fantastic way. I don't know, in the Boston area anyway, they're incredibly popular. Companies will come and present, but a lot of the more interested employees will come as well. And you get to mingle and you meet, you can give out your business cards. And then one final way is you can start a podcast.
There you go.
And introduce yourself to senior level CTOs, heads of engineering and the like. But that does take a bit more effort.
Yeah, you know, it's worth taking a moment to talk about, you know, because some of those techniques are great. Just the idea of even like just like, let's say, because a lot of times people say, well, I don't know anyone in this company, John. How do you do that? You're on podcasts or whatever, so you know. But just like what you said, like if let's say I wanted to work at XYZ company and they're my area, so I find someone on LinkedIn who works at that company, and I message them and I say, hey, I noticed that you, in your job description, you're working on such and such technology. I had a problem with this. You know, I wonder if I could ask you some questions or get your idea on this architecture I'm working on. I'm not asking them for a job. I'm not, you know, I'm just, you know, starting a conversation. And then, hey, could I buy you coffee and we could talk about this? I'd love to pick your brain on this. You're giving them, making them feel like they're smart and they're going to appreciate that. And then you're getting to know them. And then pretty soon, then, you know, it opens the way. But I think there's so many, like you're saying, you know, there's so many ways, different ways to get in contact with people rather than directly saying, hey, I need a job. That's why I'm contacting you. Like, there's other ways to build relationships.
You're one of the masses at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's say you've followed one of these strategies and you've met the person and you get into the company and it's really great. And now you want to make your way up. So, like, let's say you start at just a developer or a senior developer or something, or junior developer, and you want to start moving towards the more architect or manager or dev lead, head of engineering. How do you start making your way towards those?
So one of the key things that I've advised and I've done in my career, you know, in looking back, that I would emphasize more of is finding a mentor somewhere high up in the company, right? To be able to say, you know, again, you don't say, hey, I want to become the vice president of whatever. So I mean, that might actually even work as an approach, but in general, you say, hey, you know, I'm in this position. I read your book, or, you know, I've been following your blog, or find the thing that they're, and I really like your advice. I was wondering if you might have just like 15 minutes a week that you could just mentor me, that you could just give me some advice. You've been at the company for 15 years or 20 years. I really like the way you do things. I really like your management style, whatever it is, right? Whatever the excuse is to be able to learn from this person, and ask for 15 minutes once a week. You're probably going to get that, and you could probably go pretty high up the company and make that request. And first of all, you know, no, they're going to be shocked, because who does that, right?
They're
going to feel flattered. Yeah, and then imagine. I mean, imagine if you you're in a medium sized company and you're meeting with the CEO 15 minutes once a week for him to give you personal. You're going to be his his pet project eventually.
You're going to be the next one to get promoted.
Exactly. So there, I mean, that's just one way, right? That's if that avenue is not available to you, there's other things you could do. You could try to emulate look and see what the scene, where do you want to be? How are they dressing? How are they, you know, who are they associating with, right? You know, can you mimic those things? Can you act and look like you already are that executive? If, let's say, you wanted to be the executive, so dress and act and look like them so that it seems natural. Then they're like, wait a minute, this guy's just a junior dev. I didn't realize he was a junior dev. It seems like he's taking on projects and like doing, you know, things that are way out of his job scope, right? You know, so there's you know, again, it comes back to that fake it till you make it, yeah. or another phrase I use, which is act as if you already succeeded, as if you already are what you want to be, and then you'll become it. You just simply step right into those shoes. So you got to imagine, you got to project out and say, If I were this thing I wanted to be, what would I do? What would I look like? You know, how would I act? How would I talk? Who would I associate with? What kind of work and job would I be doing? And then you start doing those things, and then you become that thing.
I was working at a company where I saw two peers, both one very nice guy, one rather manipulative, and he did what you're describing, acted as though he was in charge of a whole team when he wasn't. was going to the CTO's office all the time. And in the end, he actually used it quite negatively to have his former friend sacked. But, you know, that's politics. That's what goes on in companies too.
Yeah, but it's amazing because I've seen the similar thing, right? And it's amazing because even when you're a total jerk, it still works.
It does.
Right? Even when you have, like, I mean, with great power comes great responsibility, right? You should use this power for good, right? Everything I'm telling you, you could call it manipulation, right? You could.
It's social engineering in a sense.
Right. It's leadership and manipulation are two sides of this, you know, two different sides of the same coin. So leadership is when you do something for someone else's good. You influence them to behave how you want for their own good, and manipulation is when you do it for your good only. So you know, I would encourage to be on the side of doing the social engineering that is leadership that helps other people, and by doing that, you know, as Zig Ziglar says, if you help enough people get what they want, you'll get what you want. That's how you get what you want. You don't do it by, you know, stepping on people's necks.
Yeah.
But it still works, right? It's amazing how I've known so many jerks that have done those kind of things. And even though it's totally transparent what they're doing, right, it still works because they're taking initiative. Because no one else is taking initiative.
Yeah. And again, so. It can look like that, can't it? I think I came across a study saying that, I can't remember the percentage, but a significantly high percentage of CEOs would be classed as sociopaths.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So let's say a person's doing all these things. I just want to move on to another topic within your book. And
sure.
They're doing their 50 hours a week. They're doing their blogs. They're learning how to become a better social engineer. A lot of devs face burnout, and they just say, I'm tired of it. I can't do it anymore. And you discussed that too.
Yeah. So and you know, and I don't want to say that there's no such thing as medical burnout, that you can't be, like, you know, burn out for health reasons. But I think that most people are just babies. And, you know, and what I mean by that is that, you know, there's stories of people that have done, like, amazing things, right? You know, I mean, if anyone, you know, if you've ever run a marathon or trained for a marathon, you know that you've got to push well beyond what you thought is comfort, right? If you've ever been, if anyone is a skilled musician, right? If you're, you know, I practiced guitar and tried to learn guitar. And if someone who's good at guitar, they've practiced past the point of where they've hated it, right? I mean, you gotta hate the thing to become good at, right? You gotta push past that. Someone who, if you've ever been a high level athlete in any sport, you've gone to practice when you just hated this sport, right? But you've decided, I'm going to go, you know, if you've, you know, lifting weights or diet, all these type of things. So my point is that a lot of people that think they have burnout, what it is they've just hit the wall. That's the test, right? And when you start the race, there's a lot of people in the race, right? But there's not a lot of people that make it to mile 26, right? There's less people there at the finish line. And that's because, you know, the wall kind of weeds people out. When you start off doing something, you have passion about it. You have motivation. You feel good about it. You start to, you know, anything you start off, I started playing guitar, you know, I feel motivated, passionate about it. I'm having success. I'm making progress, right? And then what starts to happen is you stop making progress as fast because you're not a, you know, when you're a beginner, you get that jolt and you have so much motivation and it dies off. And then pretty soon it feels like you're just not making any progress and your motivation starts to drop down, right? And you don't feel like doing it anymore. And then that's where you hit the wall. It's where you no longer have motivation. You're no longer making very much progress. And that's the test. And a lot of times, you know, when you're feeling burnt out, that's where you're at. And the question is, can you push through? Because if you can push through at that point, there's rewards on the other side. Because once you get past that wall, you know, then your motivation starts to take up again, because then your skills start to accelerate, your progress, you start making achievement again, because you get past that sticking point. And you're always going to hit a wall in anything worthwhile doing. If you're going to learn how to play guitar, you know, for example, your fingers are going to hurt. You're not going to feel like playing scales anymore. It's not going to be fun anymore. But if you set a practice schedule and you keep on pushing through that, eventually you're going to come through that wall and suddenly you're going to be able to play Stairway to Heaven, or, you know, you're going to be able to play, a song, and you're going to be excited about it again because now you have the skill. And that happens in programming. You know, it happens in anything that's worthwhile to pursue. So that's what I typically, you know, again, not to say that there's not a medical burnout, that you can't be burnout, but a lot of times the answer, my answer to people who think that they have burnout is suck it up and push through the wall. Like push harder. And you're, cause you're almost there. You're right on the other side of greatness. Like if you can go where other people won't go, if you can push hard enough to develop this skill to be able to go on without motivation, right? For a certain amount of time, that's where greatness is. It's, you know, anyone who achieves greatness in any kind of field is always, you'll always find this common thing, which is that they have somehow found within themselves the ability to push on, to keep practicing, to keep trying, even when they didn't feel like doing it, even when they had no motivation, they somehow, you know, mustered the courage, the energy to do it, and then they eventually get that motivation back. And that's, you know, that's the other side of it, I'd say, is, you know, I know a lot of people take this approach and they're like, I'm burnt out, and they go on vacation and they're like, okay, well, I'll just wait till my motivation comes back. And that's why, you know, I have a closet with yellow belts and soccer cleats, right? All these unfinished things I never did, right? All these things that I started this Android project, or I started this web app I was going to build, or I was going to do this podcast, or I was going to do this thing, right? All these unfinished projects, until you become a finisher and you don't realize that you know, this is what it feels like. Every time that, you know, when I wrote my book, when I wrote Soft Skills, after 5 chapters, I was burnt out.
Oh, that's time consuming. No doubt about it.
Of writing. But I pushed through and I made it to the end and completed it. And that's where rewards are. And so that's, you know, again, not probably my opinion on this. I realize it's not the most popular, but you know, this is, I'm pretty unyielding on this because I've seen success in my life, and every successful person I've seen has had this ability to overcome what most people would call burnout and push through it.
But you also talk about the importance of staying fit and also being both physically and mentally healthy.
Yeah, so I think there's, you know, there's some connections there too. Even in this topic of burnout, right? If you neglect the other side, if you neglect the physical fitness and the health, it not only will you probably feel less energy, but your confidence is going to suffer, right? If you are feeling in shape, if you are feeling healthy, your confidence typically goes up, which helps you. So you know, you can only neglect those other sides for so long before those things start hurting you. Even just at a mortality rate, right? It's like, you know, it's a shame to have your career be taking off and for you to die of a heart attack at like 45.
That's true.
That's a big waste. You're investing all this time and effort and energy in developing this career, and you've cut it short by 45 years. So,
but do you think developers, so a lot of companies will push their developers to work 12-hour days or 10-hour days or whatever it happens to be, and there isn't necessarily time for that. How would you suggest, what would your advice be to, let's say, people in a startup who need to push back against management and say, look, yeah, fine, we're doing really well, I'm working 60-hour weeks, my body is becoming terrible, I'm not sleeping well, whereas I know if I had a couple of hours to go to the gym, go for a swim, all would be back in balance.
So, okay. So I'll give another unpopular opinion here.
Oh, dear. Okay.
So this one is this. Don't work for the man for more than 8 hours a day. Don't do this. Like, why? Like, I understand, believe me, I understand working a 12 or 14 hour day. I've done that so much, but I did it for me. Right. Or I worked an 8 hour day for the man, you know, and then I worked a 4 or 6 hour day on top of that for me. I'm not going to work a 16-hour day for someone else. I'm sorry. I don't care how much you're paying me or what, you know, what kind of, you know, company you have. I'm not doing that. And I think too many developers are willing to do this, and that's why it happens. And I understand there's crunch weeks, right? Okay,
yeah,
you know, when your team needs you,
that's it.
You pull through and you do what you got to do. But typically, the general employment contract, at least here in the U.S., is typically 40-hour week. That's what you're expected to work. And I've, you know, my whole career, I've refused to work more than 40 hours, except for rare exceptions, right? I've been in environments where everyone else, the norm was work 60, and I worked 40, and I didn't get fired. you know, and because I worked hard and I did, you know, I wasn't sandbagging my time because you, after so much time sitting in the, in your office chair, you can't even be productive for 12 hours a day working
on
this.
Not consistently and not well. You end up writing poor code. Your head is muddled and the belief that, you know, 8 hours produces 8 units of work and 12 hours produces 12 units of work is nonsense. Other than on a one-day basis. And even on a one-day, I mean, you know, you're still going to have a drain and you're still going to start making more mistakes. And I think it tends to be, it's somebody else's, someone else isn't doing their job if you have to work excess hours. Other than exceptional circumstances. It means that the project wasn't planned correctly, there weren't enough people allocated for it, it wasn't spec'd out properly, or there was some unknown deadline that's been agreed to and shouldn't have been agreed to, or something of that nature.
Exactly, yeah. And you can't bear all those responsibilities. You know, I always encourage developers, say, okay, I mean, you got to develop your skills. This is part of the reason why you need to market yourself and develop your skills and learn so that you can say no. So you can walk away if you have to. So you can say, I mean, and don't just quit your job if you're it's a 60-hour. Just cut back to 40 and just say, hey, my family and my health is important, and this is – I put in my 8 hours for you. And if that's not good enough, you know, I understand we can leave on – you know, terminate on amicable terms and, you know, whatever, leave on good terms, but just try it. Just see what will happen. And I always say, you know, I don't know. My dad used to always say, pay yourself first, right? He used to say, yeah, you take 10% of your paycheck and pay yourself first. Well, I say, pay yourself first with your time, not just your money. So, you know, a lot of, if you're in this kind of environment where you feel like you're trapped, and then take your first hour of the day, every day, wake up 1 hour earlier and spend that hour of that time either building your side business, improving your skills so you can get away from this job, you know, somehow doing something for yourself and for your career when you're fresh. Give yourself the best hour of the day, right? Before you're burned out, before you're tired. And you maybe extend that to 2 hours and go and hit the gym or work out or run or do something, you know, give yourself the best couple of hours first and then give your employer the rest. You know, maybe employers wouldn't be too happy to hear this, but this is the truth. This is what you should be doing because no one else is going to look out for you besides you. You know, having ridiculous loyalty to a company is a fault. It's not a good thing. It's business. This is how business works, right? It's either business or it's charity. So it can never be both.
Along with your own book and obviously Dale Carnegie, are there other books you'd recommend for developers?
Sure. So just on the technical side, one book that really changed the way I code is Code Complete.
That's actually top of my list I have a list of the books that people pick, and it is on top, but it's only got 4 votes. What I was surprised, sorry, I'm interrupting, but what I was surprised with was that I thought that most of the people I'd have on would like one particular small set of books, but it's actually been everyone's like very, very disparate books. Sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, but Code Complete is definitely fantastic one of those. Yeah, and it's timeless. It, you know, a lot of the examples are C++, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. Like, it's the only book that really talks about the structure of code low level that it can change the way that you code.
I find I find that as I mature in development, going back to some of the basics, I have a slightly different view on it, and I absorb something new from it with the rereadings.
Exactly. Yep. Definitely.
Sorry again for interrupting.
Oh no, it's fine. And then Clean Code by Uncle Bob, one of my all time favorites. It's a little bit higher level, like not the quite structural level, but more I'd say like one level up. And that really changed my view on a lot of things, including comments in code and like how to make your code more expressive and refactoring code. I felt like that was just a really good book. And then on the non-technical side, there's a couple of books that I'd recommend. One of them, probably my top book for anyone that's struggling against burnout, resistance, you know, just not having the motivation to be able to get done what you need to get done. Anyone who's trying to do any kind of entrepreneurial effort is The War of Art by blanked his name, Stephen Pressfield. So this is not The Art of War by Sun Tzu.
Which is high up my list as well, actually.
Yeah, that's a good book, a tactical. But this book, The War of Art, is it's meant for writers, really, and it's just a fantastic book. Just, you know, it just goes over the things that we all struggle with as humans when we sit down. You know, it basically says that, you know, the difficult thing is not doing the work, it's not typing, it's sitting down to the desk to actually do it, right? It's the procrastination, it's all these things. And he gives some good strategies for overcoming this. And it's just written beautifully. You know, he's a fiction author that wrote this, a couple of nonfiction books. And so, you know, the writing style is just, it's great. And then, let's see, along with that, a couple of maybe more out there books is Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. This is a really old book that sort of Dale Carnegie era that has a strange title. It's a very strange book. You could say that it's kind of one of those books that sort of is responsible for the law of attraction, like the idea that, you know, if you think about a thing, that's, you'll attract more of it to you. Not that I understand there's varying levels of people's, you know, willingness to accept that kind of thinking, but this book is an extremely powerful book, and I'll tell you why. I have the opportunity to talk to a lot of millionaires, and I've talked to a few billionaires, and I always ask them, what is the one book that someone should read? And this book comes up a lot, right? So I had a lot of resistance to this book, but, you know, after reading this a few times, I understand why. There's some very powerful concepts in this, and you know, and it's a little strange. I have to warn you. And then another book that also comes up quite a bit is a book by Maxwell Maltz called Psycho-Cybernetics. This is sort of, you could consider this probably maybe the first self-help book that existed. Maxwell Maltz was a plastic surgeon who discovered that when he was performing surgeries on people's faces, altering their faces, that sometimes it would greatly alter their personality and their life when he fixed a facial defect. But sometimes it wouldn't. He'd fix the same facial defect. And he really started to realize that what we believed about ourselves, this idea of self-image, was an extremely powerful concept that shaped our lives. And this book is all about how you can shape your self-image and how that affects you, and how your brain, you know, is essentially a goal-seeking mechanism that you have to understand that if you set a goal and you believe that goal and you, you know, visualize that thing, your brain will steer you towards that goal. So really powerful. I'd say those two books are really powerful mental books for changing your outlook on life and putting you in the positive kind of mindset that can then help you achieve, you know, some major things. And again, you know, so these are a little bit out there concepts, but I talk to a lot of really, really successful people, and these books come up time and time again. It's amazing how often these books come up. So,
you know, it's always worth reading something outside of what you're familiar with to get, even if you don't like it, you'll learn something from it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Any final notes before we wrap up?
I would like to. I always like to do a little bit of a giveaway and thing here. So the first thing is, I'd like to give away a signed copy of Soft Skills, the Software Developer's Life Manual, my book, to someone who comments on this podcast episode.
Oh, nice.
And I'm a man of action, so it's not just good enough to just comment. So you got to do something. So I want you to comment and say what you're going to do now that you've heard this. You know, what has this episode motivated you to do? Give me a concrete action that you're going to do, and then whoever, you know, we can pick randomly or you can pick Brian if you'd like.
I'll leave it to you to choose.
Okay. I'll pick, based on the action. We'll say that. And then the other thing is, I do have, we talked a little bit about this, but I have a course on how to market yourself as a software developer. It's like 4 ebooks, and 2 complete video courses that go over branding and creating a blog and a whole bunch of, other concepts on things on how to boost your career. And I normally sell that for $2.99 off of my website, off of devcareerboost.com. But I'll give everyone that listened to this episode $100 off. If you go to devcareerboost.com and you just put in "no dogma" as the coupon code, you will get $100 off. Again, that's devcareerboost.com.
I'll put links to all of those things, and I'll put links to all the books that you've recommended, your own site and Twitter and everything else.
Okay, awesome.
Well, thank you very much for joining me tonight, John.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
She calls out, "I love you." I can hear it through the Father's act of love, I can hear you. Door to be open with a turnkey with a sighing as slivers, frog splinters with the rain falls and cries. She calls out to love, there's an echo I am following. I am backwards and evolving, concave and expanding. A whistle to the train and the tracks separating. I am bone bent and wavering, roots deep and unswaying. Half her voice bounces back, and the rest escapes through the cracks.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Through the Cracks by Isla Nerio from the album Hollowbone.